Welcome, everybody. This is the opening lecture for Econ 730, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. So as that high number suggests, this is a relatively advanced course for the Mises Academy. I'm not sure, but this may be the highest number yet, so you should feel proud about that. Now, what does that mean? Basically, this is going to be as complex as at least any of the things I'm going to teach probably will be, at least for a while, unless we get into main, you know, Hayekian capital theory or something for some really advanced graduate level course down the road. Let me just very briefly talk about, well, let's go ahead and go to the first slide here. So I'm looking at slide number one, how the course works. Let me just tell you a little bit about this. I think that a lot of you have taken Mises Academy courses before, so you probably don't need to have a whole history of the mechanics of it. But just very briefly, typically what's going to happen on a Wednesday, I will go for about 75 minutes or so with the prepared lecture that's tied in with the PowerPoint presentation, and then I will turn it over to your Q&A that I'll answer live by, and where you put the questions for that is in the Moodle forum. Okay, so the thing where you have to log in, that you see the course syllabus and all that kind of stuff, that's where you're going to see threads devoted to questions for the professor week one or week two or week three and so on. So that's where you want to post your questions. The reason for that being, if you try to do it in a chat box on the fly while I'm talking, it gets to be unmanageable because people post new questions and it bumps the box up and it doesn't work out that way. So this is what we settled on as the way to do it. So as I'm lecturing even tonight, if I say something that you want to ask a question about, the best thing to do is not type in the chat box because I might not see it. The best thing to do is put it in the Moodle forum, and then in the last 15 minutes of the live lecture, I'll try to get through as many of those as I can. If I don't get through it during the live lecture, I'll come back to it and type in my answer at some point, hopefully within the week. On Saturdays, there is what's called office hours. So for those of you who are in college or have been to college, you know what an office hours session is. It's not mandatory. It's just I show up and hang out for an hour and field questions. So I'll give preference to questions about the course material, but you can ask me anything at that point. People usually, those things talk about the course for about 10 minutes, and then it turns into discussions about libertarian strategy and where to put your money and all that kind of stuff, things for which I am probably unqualified to give you advice on. What else? Okay, for this class, we're trying something a little bit different, and I think it's going to be easier for you guys. If you have any kind of technical question, like you're having trouble logging in, or you're trying to take the quiz and it's not working, that kind of thing, you send your email to ta@mises.com. Okay, so the letter T as in Tom, the letter A as in Apple, @mises.com, and then that will go to the select group of people who are TAs, teaching assistants, for Mises Academy this semester, or whatever you want to call this period of time. And that's, so somebody will get back to you. All right, so this way we've broadened it. So for this class, Daniel Sanchez is sort of like the administrator for the entire Mises Academy, so he's on that list. But for this class in particular, we've got Jonathan Catalan, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, and Matthias, what is it, von Gutenberg, something like that? Yes, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. All right, so we've got two TAs dedicated just to this class, I believe. I don't think they're working on another one. And then, of course, Daniel is the overseer of everything. But again, you don't need to worry about that. The point is, you just, if you have a question that's not related to the material, but that's related to the mechanics of the course, don't send it to me because I don't know what the answer is. If you're having trouble logging in, that kind of thing, send that kind of a question to just ta@mises.com, and then somebody's going to get back to you quick. Okay, what else do we need to go over? I think those are all the logistical housekeeping matters. As with any, those of you taking me before, the structure of the class is going to be the same. We're going to just have a weekly multiple choice quiz if you're taking the class for credit, and then those will typically open up by Friday morning after the, you know, so for this week, the quiz for week one will open up on Friday and then be open through Thursday, next Thursday, and that's how that will work. And then there'll be a final exam at the end. Okay, so that's basically how it's going to work. Now, as far as the content for this class, let me just talk a little bit about what my vision is here. And it's a little bit tricky because we're walking a fine line. So on the one hand, what I for sure I want this to be is a fair education in the thought of John Maynard Keynes and then also Paul Krugman. Okay, so I want you to walk away from this course so that if you will forgive a sort of geeky expression, that you could pass a Turing test as a Keynesian or a Krugmanite. All right, so that if we took you and a bunch of people who were fans of Keynes or who were fans of Paul Krugman and put you behind a screen and had you type answers to random questions, that other fans of Keynes or Krugman couldn't tell that you really were an Austrian, that you could fake being a Keynesian or a Krugmanite. All right, so that's what my ultimate goal is for this course. If I do that, I'm happy. If I don't do that, then I think I failed. Okay, so that's the first goal I have, because I'm assuming those of you who are here, you already like Austrian economics, you know the Austrian critique. All right, so don't get me wrong, we are going to focus on that stuff. When I teach the Keynesian concepts and so forth, I will tell you what the Austrians have to say, but my point is that's not going to be the focus, right? So some of you may have been wondering, why don't we have Henry Hazlitt's The Failure of the New Economics on the syllabus for this course? It's just because we don't have enough time. In order for me in 8 weeks to cover the topics that we want to cover and to be able to give you enough time to read enough of the general theory and to read enough of Krugman's work in his own words, I can't then assign you, you know, 100 pages of Hazlitt to then knock down everything you just learned. Okay, so that's what I'm going after, and that's what governed what made it onto the reading list and not. Oh, that reminds me. So you might be wondering, if you're looking at the syllabus, like, hey, it's the start of the class and I still don't know what the week two reading material is. So that's my fault. My copy of the general theory, just I don't know where it is. So I ordered a new one. It did come in the mail, but I haven't had time to go through it totally yet. So by tomorrow, I think that stuff will all be posted on the syllabus. Okay, what you need to read for week two and week three. It's just I have to be careful because, again, it's a fine line. I know a lot of you work, and I'm afraid if I assign too much material, some of you are going to look at that and just get intimidated and say, I'm not even going to try. I'm just going to watch the lecture and get what I can that way. So to try to guard against that, I want to post a manageable amount of reading material, but yet that gets across the actual underlying thought of Keynes. All right, so let me, as one last sort of preparatory remark before we jump into tonight's material, let me just warn you, the general theory, some of you might have trouble with it, okay? And it's, to be honest, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. You might hear people say, oh, it's incomprehensible, both from critics and friends, right? Paul Samuelson has this hilarious ode to Keynes. Maybe we can dig that up for next week's lecture, because it's funny. Saying, I'm paraphrasing here, this isn't the exact word, but saying things like, you know, the book was, the general theory was filled with tangents that had little to do with the main argument, and was at times very cryptic and other places bordering on incomprehensible. And then, you know, he goes through like this, and it sounds like he's trashing it. And then at the end of this description, Samuelson says, in short, it was a work of genius. Something like that, right? And so a lot of Austrians and just free market guys in general have pointed to stuff like that and have just quoted certain passages from the general theory that were a little bit difficult to digest, to portray it as just a bunch of gobbledygook and saying the only reason it's so popular and people are so awed by it is because they don't know what he's saying, right? So the idea being that if Keynes just spoke plainly the way like Murray Rothbard did, it would be obvious what a shyster he was, And that's but because he's so incomprehensible. It's sort of like Alan Greenspan's remarks after a Fed meeting. Nobody knew what the heck he was saying because he wasn't saying anything. He just made a – he said a lot of stuff that sounded really smart, but when you tried to parse it, like, he wasn't saying anything. And so a lot of people who are critics of Keynes say that's what's true of the general theory, that it's just a bunch of gobbledygook and it's incomprehensible, and that's why it's achieved this status of alleged wisdom, because nobody knows what it says and they're afraid to admit they don't know what it's saying. So what I'm here to tell you is I didn't find that. When I was in grad school and I sat down to read the general theory, because my dissertation was on capital and interest theory, and a lot of the stuff I was getting into dealt with uncertainty and stuff like that, and it was dealing with some issues that a lot of people would call Keynesian, I realized I can't write my dissertation until I read the general theory cover to cover. So I sat down to do that thinking it was going to be awful, and it wasn't that bad. Okay, so for one thing, you might be surprised to hear this, there is one graph in the entire book, The General Theory, and even that graph, Keynes is just showing it to tell his reader, this is the kind of thing that I'm not doing here. Okay, so even the graph that's in there is not a Keynesian graph. It's a standard loanable funds market diagram that like Roger Garrison would use, and Keynes is only showing it to say, just to make sure the reader gets it, this is the thing that I'm throwing out. All right, so all the stuff that you might think of as Keynesian economics, like the ISLM curves and all that kind of stuff, and aggregate demand curves that move around and that sort of thing, and showing you, you know, where's potential output and where's actual output, those sorts of things that are littered throughout Paul Krugman's wonkish blog posts, none of that stuff is in the general theory. All right, so that's partly what we're going to learn this course, is to see the transition from the verbal exposition of Keynes's general theory through the interpretation and popularization of it by people like Hicks and Paul Samuelson, and that's where what we now think of as standard Keynesian economics actually came from. All right, so it's arguable that that's actually, in the history of economic thought, one of the popular topics is to ask, was John Maynard Keynes a Keynesian? Okay, they're not saying that tongue in cheek. They mean that literally, in the sense, the actual writings of John Maynard Keynes himself, as shown in the general theory, for example, would we now classify that as Keynesian thought if by the term Keynesian we mean the stuff that came after Keynes, the stuff that his disciples popularized and they found their way into all the, you know, big mainstream textbooks and so forth, and that today we know of as Keynesian ideas. All right, so part of this class is just a history of economic thought exploration. That you'll find it's interesting to read stuff in the original, and you'll realize the little sound bites that you learned about it are either caricatures that, you know, don't really do it justice, we'll take it a little bit out of context, or sometimes you'll see it's the exact opposite, and that what the person was saying in the original bears no relationship to what you were taught. Okay, so that's the conclusion for that sort of digression is to say, some of you might find reading Keynes difficult, and just the way the course is structured, that has to come up front, right? Chronologically, we can't do Krugman before we do Keynes, so we got to do Keynes before we talk about Krugman and the crisis. So I'm just warning you that probably the most difficult reading for some of you is going to happen in weeks 2 and 3. So for those of you who haven't done any of the reading yet, week 1, which we're going to start talking about in a minute here, reading J.B. Say and Lionel Robbins, that should be simple for you, right? That should be fun, especially J.B. Say. He's a very clear writer, and so that's fine. But week 2 and week 3, where I'm going to be assigning selections from the general theory itself, it's tricky. So again, the trade-off I'm going to have there, and that's why I'm taking so long to tell you exactly what to read, is if I don't give you enough, you're not really going to know what Keynes' worldview is, because you got to read the words. It's not like you can just look at one graph and figure out what the graph means. It doesn't have any graphs. You have to read through paragraphs and paragraphs, and he might go off on a tangent. And so it's so there's that trade-off, that the more I assign, the more likely you are to get what Keynes is saying, But again, on the other hand, the more I assign, I know some of you are real busy, and you might just say, well, this is too much reading. I'm not going to do it. So anyway, that's why it's taken me so long to get it to you. By tomorrow, that should all be posted on the syllabus, so those of you who want to get a head start can go ahead and read that. For this sort of class, if you can do it, and I know it's tricky, some of you have just signed up, but in general, if you can do the reading before you hear my lecture pertaining to that week's reading, it's going to help you. That a lot of this stuff is difficult, so it'll be good if you read it first, and then you get stuck on things and you grapple with it, then you hear me lecture on it, and then a lot of it should make a lot more sense. And then if you really have a lot of time, go back and reread it after having heard my lecture, and then it should really make sense. So, but I know for some of you that's just not gonna happen. So in any event, if you are only going to read it once, probably, well, my guess is you'd want to read it first and then hear my lecture, but if it turns out to be the other way, that's not terrible. But at least I would urge you guys to at least give it a chance. Okay, so try to at least read some of it. If for no other reason than just to see what it was like to be an economist arguing in a different time period. Because you'll see with J.B. Say and Lionel Robbins and then next week with Keynes, they write differently from how modern economists write. And so that's one benefit of doing it, is just as pure history of economic thought. Randall Swanson, I see, is asking, will the selections from the general theory be posted as PDF files? Danny and I are still figuring out what to do about that. I'm not sure right now, because it's online. You don't have to buy anything, that's for sure. But off the top of my head, I'm not sure what we're going to do about that, if we're just going to put it as a PDF or if we're just going to send you a link to some other place that's hosting it. Randall's asking, should we buy his book? Yeah, if you want to, I think that would be easier. Like that's why I ordered it, because I go nuts trying to read stuff online, like if it's long. Okay, so I needed to have the general theory in my hands to go through it carefully to be able to figure out what to assign to you guys. And that's why I'm behind, because I had to order it from Amazon because I couldn't find my copy. If you're a budding economist, you should have a copy of the general theory in your library, so you might as well order it. They're pretty cheap. It's under $20. I don't remember how much it was off Amazon. Okay. Yeah, people are asking, yeah, of course, if you've got the book, you'll be able to figure out what section it is if you have different paginations. So it's fine. Don't worry about that. It'll be clear what you're supposed to read. Okay, well, I've blathered on enough here with the preliminary stuff, so let's jump into tonight's material. So we're talking about Jean-Baptiste Say. He was one of the great French political economists. You can see his date of birth and death. So here, notice he died well before what we call the Marginal Revolution, which happened in the early 1870s. All right, so Say was definitely a classical economist. So what does that mean? If you read his stuff, a lot of it's really wonderful, but if he starts talking about how prices are formed and where value comes from, you're going to see that he embraces what we would now call a cost or a labor theory of value. Okay, so it's just very interesting, and I like to make that point because I think a lot of people assume that Karl Marx invented the labor theory of value, and that's not true. No, the labor theory of value was developed by people like Adam Smith and other classical economists, David Ricardo and so forth. All the great French free market guys adhered to it, Jean-Baptiste Say, Frederick Bastiat. You know, if you get a collection of their works and start reading through it, and you don't just focus on the real popular stuff like, you know, Bastiat's Petition of the Candlemakers and so forth, if you get their treatises and just start reading the thing cover to cover, you're going to start hitting stuff where you say, whoa, I don't agree with that. And it's not that they're calling for government intervention or anything. It's just their neutral, value-free analysis of how prices are formed in a market is not what you would get from Murray Rothbard or Mises or Karl Menger, for that matter, because Menger was part of the subjectivist marginalist revolution of the 1870s. Okay, so anyway, I just want to make sure you guys realize that when we talk about the classical economists, their great strengths were in first of all, exploding the mercantilist fallacies. I mean, that was the single most important contribution of the classical economists. But beyond that, a lot of people would say Say's biggest contribution was precisely what we're going to go over right now, and that the classical economists understood what you might call the long-run neutrality of money. And that might make a little more sense in a few minutes. Okay, so their value theory, their theory of prices, was not, by our standards, good. It was a dead end. It led to all sorts of paradoxes and contradictions. But the classical economists did have a great understanding, of course, of the benefits of free trade. And they also understood the sort of the merits of incentives in a free market and so forth, you know, Adam Smith's invisible hand, but also in terms of particular topics, this issue of how to get out of a recession, they also had some great insights that are true to this day. All right, so the particular thing that we're going to be reading from comes from what we translate as a treatise on political economy. Obviously, the original was with a French title, and that came out in 1803. Okay, so why am I assigning you a selection, an excerpt from something that came originally from 1803? Well, it's because it's very relevant to what we're going to be doing later on in this course, so I want you to get this the context of this stuff. So for one thing, as we're going to see, when people nowadays, I'm not so much talking about a historian of economic thought, because an historian of economic thought is going to be a lot more accurate, because that person would have read the stuff in the original. But if you just grab a random PhD economist from a top 20 university, let's say, and ask him or her, hey, what did Keynes do? You know, in a few sentences, you know, what was his accomplishment? They might say that, oh, what Keynes did is he overturned Say's law. He showed the limits, that Say's law was wrong, or was just focusing on a special case. And then you say, oh, well, what's Say's law? What is that? They would probably say, oh, it's the claim that supply creates its own demand. Right? That's how a lot of modern economists who have not read Say in the original would just say that's what Say's law is. That's, you know, I was taught that, and so were a lot of people. It's sort of like, for those of you who follow American politics, recently I remember how Sarah Palin got in trouble for sort of talking extemporaneously about Paul Revere's ride. It's that sort of thing here, where a lot of Americans have been taught growing up that Paul Revere rode around on horseback saying, the redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming. And then if you go and actually look at the history, that's not quite what happened. Okay, I mean, yeah, there was a guy, Paul Revere, and he was trying to communicate a warning about the British and so forth, but the conventional story that you hear is actually sort of a fable. And it's the same thing here. It's not that anyone really got up in front of a blackboard and taught you and said, oh, Say in 1803 said, quote, supply creates its own demand. Nobody ever really said that officially, but yet, to the extent that any modern economist even knows what you mean by the term Say's law, he would probably say, oh, it means supply creates its own demand. All right, so that's one thing. And that Keynes and the general theory blew that up. So that's what a lot of economists nowadays would say. And so part of the function in this class is to see if that's true. And that's partly why I have you reading Say's discussion, so you can see for yourself, is that really accurate? Because, of course, on the surface of it, the sentence supply creates its own demand is false, depending on what you take that to mean. So if somebody just starts has a restaurant and starts selling skunk sandwiches, and say, oh, here, I'm supplying skunk sandwiches, and let's see if people demand it. I mean, obviously that's silly. And for one thing, you'd have to inquire and say, well, what's the price that you're charging? It's not enough just to say there's a supply, so now is there a corresponding demand? That doesn't even make sense. But I mean, forget the skunk sandwiches. If I say there's a car factory making automobiles, will that create its own demand? That's not enough information. You need to say, well, there is a demand curve for it, but depending on the price you charge, you might not sell all the cars you made. Okay, so you can see even at step one, this phrase supply creates its own demand is very ambiguous, and depending on how you interpret it, it's either, you know, obviously false just from looking at it, or it's sort of vague and it could be true depending on how you interpret it. All right. The other reason this is important and why Say's Law is so crucial to this whole discussion is that if you go ahead and read it, and again, if you're busy and you're not going to be able to do all the reading, at least read the excerpt from J.B. Say, because it's not that long, it's very lucid, and it, if you took nothing else away from the course, I'd want you to read that just because it's good economic education, just to go through his reasoning. So what he's doing in that is he starts out by saying the merchant who's having trouble, you know, whose business is bad, often explains the situation by saying, oh, my customers don't have enough money, so that there's a dearness of money in the community or a scarcity of money. And so there, if that's the diagnosis, well, then the prescription is we just need to print more money, or we need to bring in more gold or silver if we're, you know, on a commodity standard. And so that's that mentality was responsible for some of the truly naive calls for inflation, that if you thought the reason we occasionally get into a business slump and the reason just business across the board seems to be bad is that, oh, well, people just, the customers don't have enough money. Duh. If they had more money, they would spend more, and then sales would pick up and all the businesses would be healthy again. So clearly, the way to get out of a general recession is just to give more money to everybody, and then things will be fine. Okay, so that is a particularly naive, crude version of this fallacy, but there's more sophisticated ones. And I should probably mention, a lot of people, including Mises, thought that what John Maynard Keynes really did, it's not that he brought to the table some new doctrine. That no, they thought Keynes was just resurrecting the crudest of fallacies that had been prevalent for hundreds of years in the past that the classical economists blew up, and that Keynes came along and resurrected those fallacies, the idea that the way to general prosperity is just to print more money, and that makes everybody richer. Or if business is bad, the way to fix things is have the government just spend more, and then everything will be fixed, and that's great, and that's all we need to have genuine wealth to turn stones into bread. That Mises thought, and as well as many other critics of Keynes, thought that Keynes was resurrecting these ridiculous notions that in the hands of lesser men, in the hands of cranks and so forth, everybody could clearly see were fallacious, and that had supposedly been blown up by classical economists in the 19th century, and yet Keynes came along and took those crazy ideas and policy prescriptions in presented them in this very abstract, sophisticated mathematical framework that lent itself to graphical exposition and mathematical modeling and made it look like it was brilliant. But he was really just justifying policies that made no sense on the face of them, that were just clearly ridiculous. Okay, so that's, so we'll see whether or not that's true. So I realize I'm probably stacking the deck against him, but hold off your judgment on that. Let's wait till we read Keynes in the original next week in week number 3, and you can see whether that's a fair assessment or not. But for right now, what J.B. Say is attacking is that fallacy, that idea that the reason business occasionally falls into a general slump is that just people don't have enough money. The consumers in general need more money, and if only they had more money, then that would work. Now, related to this, is on the flip side, there's two ways of looking at that. A different way of explaining the situation is to say, because again, what's the problem? When there's a general slump in business, so it's not just one store that's having trouble, but just merchants in general are getting real nervous and they're losing money and they're thinking about laying people off and so forth, why does that happen? So one explanation is to say the customers in general in the community just don't have enough money. And so that's why they're not able to spend enough. But another explanation that's sort of related is to say, oh, well, all the business people must have produced too much. And that's why they can't all sell all of their product, is because they just produce too much. All right? And so that's another way of looking at it. So the two prongs of this very crude view that Say is trying to refute in the excerpt that I've given you guys, on the one hand is to say there's just not enough money, and if only people had more money, or on the other hand to say, given the amount of money there was, businesses across the board for some inexplicable reason all produced too much. And so that's why they're all in trouble, and their inventory's piling up, and their sales aren't enough to justify what they've done, is because they all just produce too much stuff. So on the one hand, the solution would be to print more money. On the other hand, a possible solution would be for businesses to like destroy products or withhold their inventory and so forth. Okay, so what were Say's points? And again, here, I can't go through the whole thing. You really should read it in the original, but I just want to highlight a few passages. So the germ of truth in saying that Say proclaimed supply creates its own demand is he does have passages like this one, this top one, where it says, it is production which opens a demand for other products. And then later on he says, you say you only want money, I say you want other commodities. Okay, so what he's getting at here is the fact that money, so it's true, in a monetary economy, a merchant who's trying to sell his product, what does he get? He gets money. All right, so his customers need to have money in order for him to make a sale and get the money from his customers, obviously. But then Say is inquiring further and saying that's just the most superficial analysis. You can't stop there. Push it further and just think about, take a step back and look at the economy as a whole. That the reason you want money isn't that you want to be like Scrooge McDuck and go swimming in a bunch of gold coins, right? What you want the money for is so that you can go out and buy things yourself, real goods and services. So either the materials that you use in your business, the raw materials, but also the things that you live on, okay, that, consumer goods, what we would now call consumer goods. Okay, so that's, so the point is from the merchant's end, that's what you want the money for. And then looking at it the other way, Say argues or asks, and your customers, yes, you want them to have money so that they can give you money in exchange for your products. But how do they get that money in the first place? They get it by themselves producing things that others want. Because they have to convince, in order for them to get the money to give it to you to buy your product, because they want your product, they have to produce products that other people in the community want so that they can get the money from the other people in the community, so they can take the money and give it to you. Okay? So the point here is that ultimately you're trading products for products. And that money, according to Say, is just a vehicle that's facilitating those trades. That really, if the butcher wants to get the tailor to make him a suit, yes, in the immediate transaction, the butcher needs to have enough money to give to the tailor. But where does the butcher get the money in the first place? By producing more meat and selling it to people. So ultimately, the way the butcher pays for the services that the tailor provides and the material and so forth is by providing meat cut up in a certain way and so forth for people in the community. So that's what Say is getting at when he says it is production which opens the demand for other products. The point is the only way you are going to be in a position to demand products from somebody is if you previously have produced yourself. Okay? So I see some people are posting things in the chat box. Let me just clarify, everybody. Like Cliff Norman says, I lost sound, and it's posted privately. when you're posting stuff, you want to just make sure you're addressing it to everybody, because if I get in the zone and I'm lecturing here, I might not see that stuff. Okay, so if Cliff Norman did lose sound, I realize you might not be able to hear what I'm saying right now, Cliff, but the TAs, in case you didn't see it, Cliff Norman is having trouble, so can you type into the thing what he should do about his sound? Okay, so back to the lecture here. So that's the essential insight that JBSA is getting at, that in order to demand more, you must have previously produced more. And he has a clever way of illustrating the point when he talks about what he calls the miserable reign of Charles VI. And I'd have to go look up in history. I don't know if Charles VI was a bad ruler or he just meant it was a long time ago and so people were poor back then. But he has a little observation saying that people buy and sell nowadays, meaning when Say was writing in the early 1800s, five or sixfold more than they did in what he calls the miserable reign of Charles VI. And then he goes on to say, how else could that be possible except for the fact that we're all producing five or six times as much? Okay, so it seems like it's an obvious point in retrospect, and I almost feel silly just reiterating it a few times for you guys, but I just want to make sure if you've never thought of it like that, that's an incredible insight. All right, that in order for the economy to grow in general, in order for business to be booming and for sales to grow, that can only happen if the economy in general is growing and production is increasing, right? That you can't have more people buying stuff than is being produced. And again, that's so obvious, I feel silly mentioning it, but it's truisms like that later on will show us the problems with Keynesian thought and Krugman's work too. That they just, a lot of times, Krugman will write as if the source of wealth is spending. That we're going to magically create goods and services if people would only be willing to go to the store and buy them. And we have to always remember that, first of all, no, technologically, physically, somebody has to first produce that stuff before it's available for purchase. Right now, I'm getting a little ahead of ourselves. Of course, Paul Krugman's not going to deny that. Paul Krugman's not going to say, no, I believe that the very act of going to Best Buy with a $100 bill magically creates a TV on the shelf. No, he's not going to say that. But the point is, his analysis pushes him in a position where it seems that he's saying that. And he just takes it for granted that the physical production will take place so long as the demand is there. All right, well, because of time constraints, let me move on, but there would be a lot more to say about this. Let me just say one concluding thought here, and I don't know if that's going to come across clearly if you just read the selection from J.B. Say. So that's why I also included the Steve Horowitz article, just to help as a secondary source to make sure you're getting all the main points. But as far as this idea of a general glut, let me just spend a minute or two on that, because that's a pretty crucial topic. Let me just type it in the chat box to make sure you guys know what I'm saying. So the phrase general glut. So this is a particularly important topic in terms of theories of the business cycle, and the sort of standard view of what the classical economists thought in contrast to post-Keynes, or that's misleading, economists coming after the work of John Maynard Keynes. The term post-Keynesian means something specific, so I don't want to use that term. So let me give you like a standard exposition here, that if you asked a mainstream economist from Harvard right now, he would probably say something like this, that, yeah, the classical economists thought that a general glut was impossible. They thought it can't be the case that every industry across the board has overproduced, and that there's just too much product, too much inventory. They thought that was just literally impossible. And John Maynard Keynes came along and showed that they were wrong. He showed that it is possible for there to have been too much production. And specifically, what's happening is because we have a monetary economy, that's where the controversy comes in. So think of it like this, and I might be losing some of you here, and if you get a little bit lost, don't worry about it. This isn't a crucial point. I'm just trying to complete the circle here for those of you who can follow this argument. In a barter economy, so if we're not using money, if we're just trading goods against goods, there's really, you couldn't have a general glut. Okay, you could have, not every market might clear necessarily, right? There might be a shortage in one market. So depending on the price, let's say the market for chickens, and it's in a barter economy. And so to say that there's a shortage of chickens, what does that mean? Well, it means the price of chickens is too low, right? People are trying to buy chickens at the market price, and there's not enough chickens to go around, okay? I said that backwards. I'm trying to talk about a glut. Go a different way. Say there's a glut of chickens. Okay, what does that mean if there's a glut of chickens? It means the chicken farmers or whatever who have chickens and are trying to sell them at the market price, they're trying to sell more chickens than they can find buyers for, okay? That's what it would mean for there to be a glut or a surplus of chickens. But now think about it this way. If we're in a situation of barter where we're not using money, but the way people buy chickens is they bring other goods and services, well, it can't be the case, just mathematically, it can't be the case that every seller of every product in a barter situation is experiencing a glut. It can't be true that everybody in the whole economy who's selling stuff is saying, man, at the market price prevailing right now for my product, I want to sell more units than I can find buyers for. That can't be true, because if there is a glut of chickens, then that means there's at least one person out there who's trying to buy chickens with some other good who's experiencing a shortage. All right, so because we're running out of time, I don't want to dwell too long on that. That's either going to click with you, and you're going to say, oh, and now you're going to be enlightened and walk around seeing the world with different eyes, or you have no clue what I'm talking about. But I don't want to go deeper on that. So that's just, in a barter economy, it is mathematically impossible for there to be a general glut. It can't be the case that every single market has a price that's too high, that's above the equilibrium or the market clearing price. Because, you know, if you talk about somebody selling oranges for chickens, well, that's just the flip side of somebody selling chickens for oranges. So it can't be true that the chicken price of oranges is too high and the orange price of chickens is too high. All right, so hopefully I just drove the point home there. That if one of those prices is too high, that means the other price is too low. So if the chicken market is in surplus or a glut vis-a-vis the people who have oranges and are trying to buy chickens with the oranges, then it has to be true mathematically that the orange market is in a shortage situation relative to the people who have chickens and are trying to buy oranges. Okay, so so that sort of logic that is animating J.B. Say's thought here, because he's sort of abstracting away from money. He's thinking about, he's taking money out of the picture for a moment. He's viewing money as sort of just like a vehicle that facilitates transactions. And he's saying, really what's going on in an economy is we're trading goods for goods. And that money is just this intermediate thing. And so if you take money out of it for a minute and think about a barter situation, well then clearly you can't have a general glut. And so that is what saying argues in several points, several passages. I'm not sure if they're all in the excerpt I gave you tonight, but he does argue elsewhere that what can happen, it's true. So Say is not being some sort of like Dr. Pangloss saying everything's always fine. No, he admits certain industries might be in a glut. They may have overproduced. But the point is, to say they overproduced, what does that mean? It means, and here I'm using modern language, that they used too many resources to produce too much of their product, because those resources, at least on the margin, they should have produced less to free up some of those resources to go produce something else. So it's not true that everybody produced too much. It's what happens is when business makes mistakes, engages in what we would now call malinvestments, some sectors produce too much, but then other sectors produce too little. And the reason we can say it's impossible for there to be a general overproduction is that, look at the economy is, in general, if we look at it like in intervals of 10 years, is producing more of just about everything, or at least the things that aren't becoming obsolete. Food production goes up, housing production goes up, luxury good production goes up, so forth. And so it just, there needs to be the right balance. So let me just give you an example. We know that if the economy is healthy and the Fed doesn't keep up its crazy policies in general, 50 years from now, real GDP is going to be bigger than it is today. But if things are sensible, it's going to be bigger because various sectors are going to all grow. It's not that the production of pencils is going to go up by a factor of a trillion and everything else is going to stay the same, and that's why total real GDP 50 years from now is going to be bigger, if you guys get what I'm saying. That no, various sectors all grow in tandem, some more than others, in the way that best satisfies consumer preferences. Okay, so that's what Say is getting at, that yes, it is possible for individual industries to have grown too quickly, but what that means is it's not that having extra Parkers or having extra champagne is bad. To say they grew too much, meaning relative to what? Well, because those resources should have been channeled elsewhere. That, yeah, maybe instead of making an extra 1,000 bottles of champagne this year, we only should have made an extra 800, and then the resources that went into those 200 could have better been used to making more, to raising more livestock or something, so that the food supply can go up too. Okay, so that's the idea. And the modern Keynesians, they're going to say the flaw with that thinking is that Say didn't adequately take into account the role that money plays in a modern market economy. Okay, and so this is actually why I mentioned in the beginning of the lecture, my own work led me to Keynes, is that when you try to seriously entertain the role that money plays in the economy, you get into areas that were dealt with by Keynes, and he's one of the pioneers in this sort of thing. Okay, so this is why the Keynesians think that they're more scientific, they think they're being more realistic, is they're saying J.B. Say's analysis is true if money is neutral. That if we were just dealing with a barter economy, then yep, everything Say says is perfectly correct, but where he goes astray is if you introduce money, and that can screw everything up, and the economy can get stuck for a long time with the output of every other good being too high, and the thing that's in shortage is money. Okay, so let me just I realize I went on for more time than I thought I would, but let me just bring that discussion to a close here with the grand finale, where we've been leading up to. So go back to what I said before. Remember, I argued a barter economy cannot be experiencing a general glut, just mathematically. That if there's too many chickens relative to the people who want to buy them with oranges, well, yeah, there's a chicken glut or a chicken surplus, but then there must be a shortage of oranges. So in general, it can't be that every producer is experiencing a glut. But now what happens if I say, wait a minute, one of the goods now is the money commodity. Now, mathematically, my argument falls away, because it could be true that all of the goods are in surplus except the money good. And there's nothing mathematically wrong about what I just said. That's possible. And so you could see that, so what would that mean? It would mean the price of everything against money is too high. And so you could have a surplus in every market, in the chicken market, in the orange market, in the parka market, radio market, what have you, and the one good for which there would be a shortage would be the money commodity. And so that's mathematically possible. I can't use my arguments about barter to rule that out, because if you think about it, it's like it's a barter economy, and the one good that's absorbing all of the shortages is the money commodity. Okay, so that's but if you, so you can't use that though to say, ah, see, J.B. Say's wrong, because that's exactly what the merchant was saying at the beginning of Say's article. The so-called naive merchant was saying, oh, there's a dearness of money. If only my customers had more money, then everything would be fixed. The Keynesians are going to say, you see, you classical economists and you modern economists who are free market fans who think J.B. Say is a genius in this excerpt, no, you guys are missing the boat here. You're assuming away the problem. You're saying, let's forget about money. Let's just think about it in terms of barter. And oh, we conclude that there can't be a general glut under barter, so now we're done. We just proved that these merchants are naive. And the Keynesian's going to say, no, because in the real world, one of the commodities is the money good, and so maybe that's the thing for which there's a shortage and there's a surplus of everything else. And that's what Keynes is going to argue. And so there, you know, how does that happen? Well, because the money prices are stuck. They can't fall. Okay, so I'm sort of jumping ahead of myself, but here I'm trying to show you the way the argument's going to go if you get talk to a real sophisticated Keynesian like Brad DeLong. That's what they're going to say. So having said all that, I want you to have read J.B. Say so you understand what his argument was, and you can see, in other words, you need to understand from the ground floor the basic truth in what Say is talking about, and then as we go on and read Keynes, we'll see, did Say really leave this sort of loophole in his argument that the Keynesians can come in and defeat him with? Okay. So we've got about 23 minutes left by my clock to talk about Lionel Robbins, so let's go ahead and move on here. So for those of you listening to this after the fact, I'm now looking at slide 3 on Lionel Robbins. So you can see he obviously came much later than J.B. Say did. And the excerpt that I have for you guys on the syllabus comes from, I think it's the second last chapter of his book, The Great Depression. So this came out in 1934. So let me just reiterate, I put this in a note in the syllabus, but I'll say it again here. In terms of you doing the reading for week one, I definitely want you to carefully read through the J.B. Say excerpt. You know, read it top to bottom carefully and, you know, at a slow enough pace that you can absorb it, because that's really great stuff that you should just know in general as part of your free market worldview. The Lionel Robbins excerpt, not so much, because it's, first of all, he's harder to understand. His writing is more turgid than Say's is. And also, the particular minutiae of his observations and so forth, that we don't need to know that stuff. The reason I'm giving you that, I just want you to skim it to see when Lionel Robbins in 1934, near the end of this book where he explains what he thinks happened so far, because remember, the Great Depression was just awful. The first few years of it were devastating. That's where the huge drop in production and in prices and so forth and the huge increase in unemployment happened. And then it just basically, economies were stuck in that depressed state for the next decade. But the actual, you know, huge plunge occurred in the first few years. So Robbins here, so it's not as if, in case you're not sure about the history of the Great Depression, it's not like Robbins here hasn't seen the worst of it yet. No, he has seen the worst of it by the time this book has come out. So why I'm giving you this, assigning you this, so why do we care about this stuff, is that, again, sort of like when you, if you asked a regular economist nowadays about J.B. Say and Keynes, by the same token, if you said what happened with the Great Depression and why did Keynesian economics win the day, you'll probably hear something like this, that, well, up until the Great Depression, the free market seemed to be okay. Yeah, there were occasionally business crises, what they might have called financial panics or depressions with a small d, but they only lasted a year or two and things generally got back on course pretty quickly, and so it wasn't a big deal. But for some reason, after the 29 stock market crash, all the major economies of the world plunged into an awful depression, and the free market economists, you know, their solutions no longer worked. That they were baffled. They had no idea what was going on because they believed in Say's law. They thought a general glut was impossible. They thought the government should just sit back and let prices change to equilibrate the markets and to clear the markets, and everything would be fixed. And yet the Great Depression just kept lingering on and on and on, and finally the public just couldn't stand it anymore. And thank goodness John Maynard Keynes came along to provide a theoretical framework to explain how the classical worldview was wrong. And Keynes explained what was happening, and then governments instituted the Keynesian solutions and got us out of the depression. And then we haven't had another major depression since then, because governments since the 1930s have all instituted what we call counter-cyclical Keynesian policies. So now we never get into that sort of rut again. And so that's the general version of history if you asked a modern economist who wasn't an Austrian or something like that. Right? That's what they would tell you. And if you read just a standard history book dealing with the 1930s, they would probably give you some version of that story, that Herbert Hoover in particular was a real dogmatic, conservative, laissez-faire president, and he didn't think it was the federal government's business to try to alleviate the severe plunge that happened after the stock market crash, and things were just, you know, imploding. And Hoover just sat around playing the fiddle or whatever, and finally, thank goodness, FDR got elected because the country wanted action. And then FDR did the New Deal, and that's what got us out of the Depression. All right, so again, don't misunderstand. I don't agree with everything I just said, with anything that I just said. I'm saying that is the conventional history that you will hear both from economists and historians who aren't experts in the area. That's the stereotypical view. And so that's partly why I wanted you to read or skim the excerpt from Lionel Robbins, is I want you to see Robbins is not at a loss to explain what happened. Robbins thinks he knows why the Great Depression has been so awful compared to previous ones and why they're stuck in that slump. And what you may be surprised to learn is the central banks of the period were actually interventionist or activist. And not only that, but it was unusual for them to be doing that. Okay, so they changed their policies. The central banks during the early 1930s were instituting policies that were different from what they had done during all previous crises. And I've argued elsewhere, those of you who are familiar with my work on Herbert Hoover and the Great Depression more generally, that it's the same thing with Herbert Hoover's policies in terms of the federal government in the United States, that far from him sitting back and doing nothing, Herbert Hoover was the most interventionist U.S. president in history up to that point, at least during peacetime. Okay, so during World War I, the U.S. government obviously intervened more in the economy, but in terms of if we're not at a war, what should the U.S. government be doing just to help the economy get out of a slump? Herbert Hoover, hands down, did way more than any of his predecessors. So now when we're trying to figure out after the fact, man, what was it about the 1930s that made the economy just get stuck in this rut for a whole decade? Why didn't the market bounce back like it normally did every other time throughout history up to that point? Well, it's not because, oh, the free market failed. No, the obvious explanation is it's because the free market wasn't allowed to work in this situation. All right, let me give a plug for my book here, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. You can get it from the Mises bookstore, or I think it's probably cheaper on Amazon, but don't tell anyone I told you that. So let me, as far as English, Lionel Robbins, I read his whole book. It was one of my primary sources for doing research for my book, and it's a wonderful book. because he's, how can I put it? It's just interesting to see his perspective on things. Okay, because Lionel Robbins was a great economist. He was an Austrian sympathizer. Okay, so he was instrumental in getting Hayek to go and give his famous lectures at the London School of Economics. Lionel Robbins was one of the guys involved in making that happen, where Hayek really lectured upon and taught about what we now call the Hayekian Triangle. Okay, so that those were some famous lectures that Hayek gave there at the LSE, and Lionel Robbins was instrumental in that. So Robbins was actually one of the ones who introduced what we now call Austrian ideas, especially about the business cycle. Robbins was one of the ones who introduced those ideas to the English-speaking world in the early 30s. So, you know, it's not so much that in that book, The Great Depression, even though that's put out, the version I showed you here on this slide, this version, this book on the right hand side, that's the version the Mises Institute puts out. If you read it, it's not so much that he gives an explicitly Austrian version. You know, it's not that he quotes extensively from Ludwig von Mises and says this is what happened. Okay, but the point is, and that's again why I'm showing you his policy recommendations. The point is that Robbins, if you go through and look at it, he's not talking about things like, oh, we need to balance the budget, or oh, we need to do whatever, you know, have tax breaks targeted for business investment thing. No, he just spends page after page talking about monetary policy, because he thinks that central banks were one of the primary reasons for the continuation of the slump. So let me just read you a quote I have from Robbins in my book here. So the section that I include this in is called Propping Up Losers. And let me just give you a little bit of the background first. This is the thing, is you need to know what were central banks doing before the 1930s. Because central banks weren't invented during the Great Depression. That the Federal Reserve, of course, was formally created at the end of 1913 and sort of opened its doors for business in 1914. And other central banks had been around for a lot longer. The Bank of England was the first modern incarnation of what we now know of as a central bank. And so that, of course, was formed decades before that and was the model upon which the Fed was founded, that and the Bank of France and so forth. So don't misunderstand me. It's not that Lionel Robbins is blaming the Great Depression on the existence of central banks. No, he's blaming it on the fact that central banks changed the way they behaved after a crisis. So before then, what they would do, it could be summed up in Walter, and here I forget how you pronounce this guy's name. I'll type it out. It's either Bagaho or Bagahot, but it's Walter. That's how you spell it. And so he had written a lot, Walt Badgett? Am I saying it right? Badgett? Walter Badgett? Danny's done. Okay, well, there you go. Walter Badgett. Okay, I have heard people say that before, but I didn't know they were talking about him. Well, there you go. I do most of my work through reading, not through listening to lectures. Okay, so what his recommendation was in the late 19th century was to say that when there's a crisis, when there's a panic, the central bank should come in and discount freely, but at a high rate of discount. And so what does he mean by that? He's saying to discount meant that the central bank would, if you gave it some assets, it would discount them. So it would give you a loan, basically, using those assets as collateral. And but what Badgett is saying is at a high rate of discount, meaning a high interest rate. So the point is, he was saying if business gets in trouble and there's a crisis, what we would now call a credit crunch, then go ahead and as a central bank, you're supposed to go ahead and provide liquidity, but you do it with a high interest rate. And so the rationale there was That would it would ensure that businesses that were solvent but illiquid could get loans, so they could remain ongoing enterprises. Because if you were, you know, business and you knew, yeah, our assets are worth more than our liabilities, we're a going enterprise, we should stay in business here, it's just we have a cash crunch, that we owe some people some money next week, and our assets are not going to bring in the cash to meet those obligations until 3 months from now, but, you know, it would be just crazy for us to liquidate everything and shut down, because we're very profitable, it's just we had this cash crunch. If we could just get somebody to lend us some money and get us over this hump, we'd be fine. So that's what the central bank was supposed to do, according to Badgett and other sort of conservative advisors to, or people writing policy advice for the proper administration of central banks. So the high rate of discount, what does that do? It weeds out the losers. If you're a business enterprise and you really should just go bankrupt and just shut down, well then, you shouldn't be able to get a loan very easily. Okay, so the point of, you know, Badgett's advice was not to prop up businesses that were unsound. The point was to provide liquidity to those businesses that were solvent but illiquid. Okay, so that's what the advice was. So now here, so again, the point was not to prevent firms from failing. The point was to prevent good firms from failing. You wanted the bad firms to go under to sort of get rid of the rubbish or what have you. Okay? So now here is, so after summarizing what the conventional wisdom used to be and what the policies that central banks would put in place in prior crises would have been, now Lionel Robbins is writing in 1934 saying why it's different this time. Okay. So this is Robbins now from the 1934 book. In the present depression, we have changed all that. We eschew the sharp purge. We prefer the lingering disease. Everywhere in the muddy market, in the commodity markets, in the broad field of company finance and public indebtedness, the efforts of central banks and governments have been directed to propping up bad business positions. We can see this most vividly in the sphere of central banking policy. The moment the boom broke in 1929, the central banks of the world, acting obviously in concert, set to work to create a condition of easy money quite out of relation to the general conditions of the money market. This policy was backed up by vigorous purchases of securities in the open market in the United States of America. From October 29 to December 1930, no less than $410 million was pumped in the market this way. The result was as might have been expected. The process of liquidation was arrested. New loans were floated. Okay, so what he's getting at is the normal purging that would have occurred where the unsound enterprises are allowed to fail, and that frees up resources to then get reallocated to the ones that are doing a better job. That process didn't happen. The central banks, not only were they providing liquidity, but they were doing it at ridiculously low prices. And so they weren't rationing the available savings to those businesses that really needed it and could use it productively. They were instead just throwing around cheap money, easy money, and that was allowing businesses that should have gone under to actually linger on, to limp along. Okay, so you can see that is whatever else you take away from that, and somebody like Paul Krugman, and I'm not just literally, Paul Krugman within the last week made fun of Lionel Robbins. I forget what the context was, but somehow he came across Lionel Robbins' 1934 book and just said, you know, this guy's insane, and just was quoting things from him and saying, can you believe this? This guy thinks the problem was that the central banks were too easy and so forth. But my point is, the conventional story that you hear is wrong. It's not that we're chugging along and all of a sudden for some reason the free market policies no longer worked. No, the central banks and governments did the opposite of what they used to do, and then they got the opposite results, and somehow people blame that on the free market. So let me give you some empirical evidence here. This is the New York Fed's discount rate. So back then, the Federal Reserve didn't have a single policy, right? It was a lot more autonomous back then. That each branch of the Federal Reserve, you know, had its own policies and so forth. So the most important one was the New York, because that was the one centered in New York City. So that, if you want to look and see what was Fed policy like, that's a good proxy for it. So look at what happened here. So in October 29, the discount rate was at 6%. The stock market crashes. And then look what the Fed did. They just kept cutting down to, I think that's 1.5%. It might be a little bit more by spring of 31. All right, so that is a pretty big drop. And what you don't know from this chart is that level there where they held it for the spring and summer of 31 was a record low. So since the Fed had been formed in 1913, they had never had discount rates that low in the entire history of the Fed up until this point. Now, it's true, they jacked it up, you can see there, in the fall of 1931. And the reason they did that is that Great Britain went off the gold standard right at this period. And investors around the world were spooked, and they said, whoa, if Great Britain just abandoned gold, well, maybe the United States is going to also. And so they've got panicked, and they started turning in their dollars to get gold out of the U.S. because they thought the U.S. was going to go off the gold standard, so they wanted to cash in their dollars and get the gold while they still could. And so at this point, you know, whatever else you might say against him, to his credit, Herbert Hoover wasn't going to go off the gold standard. He thought that would be an ungentlemanly thing to do and uncivilized and a breach of contract. So he was like, no, we can't go off the gold standard. So the Fed had to raise interest rates to prevent the outflow of gold at that point. So various interventionists will point to that and say, see, the gold standard tied our hands and caused us to engage in contractionary monetary policy because the outflow of gold made them raise interest rates. When we all know the last thing in the world you want to do is raise interest rates during a prolonged slump. Okay, but you know, 2 points are there. So one is using Walter Badgett's famous dictum, in prior slumps, they did have high discount rates. That was the point. There was a rationale for that, that you wanted to ration credit and only give it to the truly deserving firms and let the other ones go under. And the other thing is they tried cutting interest rates. Look at it. They were started at 6% when the market crashed. They went all the way down to about 1.5% several years later. All right? So it's not the case that we didn't try cutting interest. Now, of course, you could say, oh, we didn't cut enough. But the point is this chart does not line up with the standard story you would get if you read Brad DeLong or Paul Krugman talking about how the gold standard was partly responsible for the Great Depression. So let me talk a little bit about that. In the few minutes we have here, as one thing first. Well, hang on, let me jump. I'm going to jump ahead. So for those of you who are listening online or listening to this after the fact, I'm moving out of order with the slides here because I'm talking about gold right now. So I'm jumping ahead. Was it the fault of gold? Let me just look at this last thing first. So I'm looking at the 13th slide overall. It's B, called the smoking gun. This chart is what a Brad DeLong or a Paul Krugman will point to try to prove that the gold standard was partly responsible for the prolonged slump of the Great Depression. And what happens is that if you look at, so this is showing the index of industrial output. So they all are normalized and set to an index level of 100 at 1929, and then it shows each country how proportionally it's, or in terms of percentage terms, how its industrial output first plunged severely and then finally recovered. And so the idea is, if you look at the arrangement of these countries, it generally matches up with how early they abandoned gold. All right, so Britain, for example, went off the gold standard in 1931, whereas the United States only went off the gold standard when FDR came into office in 1933. And so the Keynesians are going to say, yep, see, Great Britain in 1937 its industrial output had recovered a lot more than the United States did, and that's because Great Britain went off gold earlier. And so that freed up their central banks to do the right Keynesian things, to pump in more money, to deficit spend and so forth, because they weren't worried about all their gold reserves getting drained out of the country. It's because they left gold. All right, so it's so this, like I said, this is considered to be a smoking gun in the Keynesian argument against the gold standard. So just a couple of quick responses. For one thing, it's the dates don't line up. All right, so just take the United States, for example. Look at where the United States bottoms out and starts recovering. It's in 1932, when Herbert Hoover was still in office. The U.S. didn't actually go off the gold standard until March 1933, or at least that's when Roosevelt started doing all his crazy banking act stuff, and it might have been a few months afterwards where they officially went off gold. Okay, and so if you look at the thing, you can see from 1932 to 1933, there was actually a rebound, and then industrial output leveled off. And what you need to know here is the notches here are designating the midpoint of the year. So the notch above 1933, I think, is actually in June of 1933. So what that's really showing is the economy bottomed out, started recovering, and then when Roosevelt went off the gold standard, you got a year of flat, and then it started going up again at the same rate that it was going up before we went off gold. Okay, so in terms of the United States, that chart doesn't show at all what Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman thinks that it shows. And the other thing is, we're supposed to be thinking that, oh, it was the gold standard that explains why the Great Depression was so bad. But yet, with the exception of France here, all these countries were off gold in the early 1930s. Okay, I think France, I don't remember exactly when they went off, but it was later in the decade. And so that's why they say, oh, see, yep, France is lagging behind because they foolishly clung to the gold standard for way too long. But the point is, the U.S. went off the gold standard in the first half of 1933. The U.S. was still clearly in a depression by 1940, and I would argue that even during World War II, but the figures got all screwed up by the wartime spending and price controls. All right, so from 1933 to 1940, that period right there would have been the worst slump in U.S. history up to that point. So it's clearly not the fault of the gold standard that the Depression lasted so long, because we were off the gold standard by 33. Okay, there's a few more points here. The gold standard, another thing you need to know, so now for those of you who can't see the slides, the order I'm going in, I'm now looking at slide, it's marked A, classical versus gold exchange standard. Murray Rothbard talks a lot about this, and if you get my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression, I talk about it more in depth there. It's not like we were on the standard classical gold standard up until 1933, and then countries started going off, or in the early 30s. No, all the major belligerents except the U.S. went off the gold standard in World War I. And then through the 1920s, they half-heartedly came back on the gold standard to varying degrees. And so what you had by the end of the 20s was not really the classical gold standard where citizens were walking around, you know, with gold coins in their pockets. Instead, you had the various nations were basically on paper money standards, and then their central bank was tied to either U.S. dollars or British pounds, which were in turn tied to gold. Okay, so with the time we have now, I can't really get into it, but my point is just, in terms of your understanding of history, don't walk around thinking that the world was on the gold standard and then it all fell apart in the early 1930s. No, everybody except the U.S. totally went off the gold standard in World War I, which was in the late nineteen teens, remember, and then some of them just came back slowly and half-heartedly in the 20s. And so it was a makeshift. It wasn't really the old classical gold standard. And that was the system that was like a house of cards that fell apart in the early 1930s. So it was not a failure of the classical gold standard. What happened is the old classical gold standard would have made World War I impossible. And so governments consciously said, we're going off gold because we want to run massive deficits so we can buy stuff to blow each other up. And the gold standard would make that impossible. So it was World War I that swept away the old classical gold standard. And then the system they had in place after there was clearly unworkable, and it blew up in their faces in the early 1930s. And then even after everybody went off gold, we still had a depression for an agonizing period after that. So it's, to say it was the fault of the gold standard is crazy. Okay, last slide, and I'll turn over your questions. So now I'm looking at the Fed's response. This is the 10th slide in the PowerPoint showing the monetary base. And so here I just want you to see, because again, the conventional wisdom is the Fed did nothing after the stock market crash under Herbert Hoover, and that's why things got so bad. And unfortunately, FDR came in and saved the day, took us off gold, and then the monetary base started going, or the money supply went up. So this monetary base chart history starts in 1918, so you can see that it zooms up. Let me see if I can get my marker going here. Okay, so you see how it zooms up here? So that's because of World War I, that the government was running massive deficits, and so they wanted the Fed to monetize that, and so the Fed was buying assets like crazy. So that caused big price inflation. So the Fed in 1920, thereabouts, jacked up interest rates to what were then record highs, and the monetary base, you can see, crashed. So why am I focusing on this? Because Tom Woods and I like to point out that the depression of 1920 and 21, the Fed crashed the monetary base, prices fell much harder than they fell at any point during the Great Depression years, and the federal government slashed spending by 65% in a single year because this was the World War I ended, and so now they didn't need to spend all this money on the war effort. And yet, that didn't lead to a decade of disaster. It was a pretty short but sharp depression, and then we had the Roaring Twenties. Okay. Now you can see it's a little bit of a difficulty for Austrian business cycle theory because you don't see a humongous increase in the monetary base during the 20s. So that's true. In a different class, we can talk about that. But my point here for you guys is look at the FDR didn't come into office until 1933, but well before then, you can see there was a big surge in the monetary base. So it's not really true to say that the Fed, you know, had its hands tied and didn't do anything, and that's why the Great Depression got to be so bad after the stock market crash. Okay, I went a little bit longer there than I had intended to, so let me go ahead and load up your questions. And I think Moodle will probably kick me out, so I'm going to have to log back in. Richard says, is there any specific chapter or section from Lionel Robbins' The Great Depression that would be more relevant to the course than the rest? Well, Richard, I'm not sure if you understood, but yeah, I mean, you were just supposed to read the excerpt that I put up there, so I think it was the second last chapter. If you're asking, is there other stuff that you should read that's relevant, I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately. I would just recommend looking at the table of contents and seeing what things look interesting to you. Because at parts, he gets into real specific details about the British situation that I don't think you need to get into so much. It's hard to say. I think you just flip through it. But for the purposes of our class, this class, you just need to look at, I think it's the second last chapter where he's giving his prescriptions of what should we do? And the point there is he's talking about monetary policy because he thinks it's because central banks have screwed with the money, we don't have sound money anymore, that's what's causing uncertainty and that's what's messing everything up. Okay, Ron Turley says, I think what Say is saying is that the wealth of a community is related to the extent to which its members are working productively. But it is expectation of success that leads someone to start a business and provide a good or service. And is this not the expectation that there will be demand? If everyone is pessimistic and hoarding cash, then the expectation of success would be rather low, and so forth. Okay. So he says, surely government-funded building programs such as the Hoover Dam or the Interstate Highway System would foster an expectation of success among potential entrepreneurs. Would this not encourage a supply of labor and materials? I can see a problem with digging holes and filling them, as this may encourage only shovel and pick manufacturers. In the end, does not create anything of value. But is it not likely that government expenditure on infrastructure would increase expectation and encourage expansion? Well, we're not gonna. We don't have the tools right now to fully answer your question. So you have put your finger on the Keynesian position. So you're right. Everybody agrees, sophisticated modern Keynesians and J.B. Say and everybody in between, that if the economy really is already its full productive capacity, just creating more money isn't going to make us richer. Right? The green pieces of paper or creating electronic bank credits isn't going to by itself cause there to be more food or more clothes or more computers. What the Keynesians are saying, though, is the economy can get stuck in a rut in which the actual productive physical resources are not being fully exploited, that production really is below its potential level of output, and injecting new money or having the government run big deficits can, they claim, cause businesses to alter their behavior such that they start employing some of those previously idle resources. So it's so I'm not going to, in a few minutes we have left here, try to answer your question, because you're basically stating a version of what the Keynesian position is, and that's what we're going to try to explore throughout this class. So you're asking a good question, and you're right. That's exactly what the Keynesian would say in response to J.B. Say. Okay, Andrew Robbins says, could you please touch on Say's law and how it relates to the banking sector, specifically the intertemporal coordination provided? I find this extremely fascinating and would like a more in-depth explanation. Okay, and just so you guys know, I'm going to go until 35 after, just so you can pace yourselves, because I went a little bit long in my formal lecture, so to give time for these questions, I'll go until 35. So I'll just spend a few minutes on Andrew's question, and then it looks like there's two other ones. I'm not sure if this is what you had in mind, Andrew, but things can get really complicated. So for those of you who are just taking this as a general class and you're not economists formally, I may be saying something that's a little bit tricky for you. And Andrew's clarifying in the chat box here, saying, I guess what I was getting at is how individuals may save their money instead of immediately exchanging it for other goods, thereby providing a seeming delay in demand. Right. Well, that's good. So I'll focus on that and not the thing that I thought maybe you were getting at, which is more complicated. Okay. So what you're just talking about here, you're right. And this is a problem. So again, the rhetorical approach that Say adopts is to abstract away from money and to say, yeah, we use money in the real world, but come on, in the grand scheme of things, we're all trading our commodities for other commodities. And so the problem when there's a general depression, it's not that your customers don't have enough money. The problem is they're not producing enough. And if we could just all produce more, we'd all be richer. Whereas if we all just had more money, just prices would go up. We wouldn't be richer, right? So maybe the way I just put that, maybe that's the essential insight of Say, is that if you had to choose, and you say right now we're in a glut or we're in a general slump, what do you want to have happen? You don't really want to just say, oh, if only everybody in the community had twice as much money, that would fix everything. No, you want everyone in the community to be twice as productive, because then we'd have twice as much stuff, and we'd be richer in real terms. We'd be that much wealthier. All right, so what Andrew, though, is asking is, wait a minute, in the real world, if I, let's say I produce something and I get money, I don't immediately go spend it on something else. I might hoard the money. I might save it, add it to my cash balances and keep it there for a while and then make a purchase down the road. And so isn't, say, leaving out something kind of important in terms of coordinating production decisions over time? And you're right, that is true. And in general, I mean, that's one of the problems with the sort of real quick, glib free market responses to Keynesian arguments, that a Keynesian might say, oh my gosh, it's a problem. If everyone just starts saving more, then spending on businesses drops, and the businesses might start laying people off, and income drops, and therefore we could fall into a recession. So that's, you know, the paradox of thrift. If the whole community tries to save more, we all end up poorer, even though if any individual household saves more, that household is obviously going to be better off in the long run in terms of its financial position. So the glib free market response to that is to say, well, not necessarily, because if households spend less today, they're going to have more to spend in the future. And so as long as businesses correctly anticipate that and figure out what happened, the consumption goods industries lay people off today, but the capital goods industries expand their output. And then so it's just a rearrangement of production, and as long as prices and employment patterns all mesh, it can accommodate itself to any desired intertemporal spending decisions by the consumers. So that is true, but in the real world, if all of a sudden everybody just starts saving 90% of their income, I mean, entrepreneurs don't see that coming. That's going to take them by surprise, and that's going to cause a serious transitional problem. So I think you're right, Andrew, that admittedly is abstracting away from what money does in the real world economy. And so it's not obvious that he's fully correct and that all we need to do is read that excerpt from Say and, you know, clap or wipe our hands clean and say, yep, we're done. We've just figured out what happens in recessions. Okay, let's got two more questions here. Aaron says, I take Say to be making a two-step argument, the first step of which is the premise that we are able to pay for our purchases only out of what we produce. From that premise, he moves to the second step and draws the conclusion that production is the source of wealth. I can imagine a critic making the following counter-argument. We are able to produce only because there is a demand for our product. Therefore, it is demand rather than supply that is the source of wealth. Another critic might say that both positions contain an element of truth, so supply and demand depend on each other. And, you know, so how do we respond to that sort of thing? Well, I think you're right. It's because what's going on here is the price system is crucial. So if you produce, so it's not correct to say, uh-oh, I produce too much, I need to have the demand for my product or else I can't move it. No, you can move any quantity of the product so long as you lower the price. And what a sophisticated exposition of Say's law would say is that if someone who thinks, my inventory is building up I don't have sufficient demand for my product, really what you mean is at the price that you're charging, you've produced more than you can move than your customers want to buy. So the solution, in the short term at least, is for you to lower your price. And now if it turns out that at that lower price you're losing money, that you're saying, well, gee, if I had known beforehand when I was creating this inventory, if I had realized the price I was going to have to charge in order to move it all, I wouldn't have made so much. Then Say is going to argue, okay, well, then that means you engaged in faulty forecasting and you produced too much. But the point is, that can't be true of every entrepreneur in the whole economy. Some entrepreneurs produce too little, because it can't be the case that everybody is producing too much. Since if that were true, then we would say, oh, we're worse off now than we were under the reign of Charles VI because now we're all we're producing five times more stuff than we did back then. But we all realize, no, that's what it means to say we're better off, that we're producing more of everything. But you want to do it in the right proportions according to consumer tastes, and that's what the profit and loss system does for you. So I'm not sure, Aaron, if I'm answering your question. I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, it's wrong to say it's either supply or demand, because that doesn't really even make any sense. To say, here's my quantity supplied of my product, is there sufficient demand for it? Well, yeah, there always is if I lower the price low enough, assuming, you know, the thing isn't poisonous or something that people don't, you know, that you'd have to pay them to take it from you. So it's not really, it's too crude and cumbersome to say, is there enough demand for my product? The point is, at the price that I would need to charge to move all my inventory, is that a price at which I'm glad that I did it in the first place, or am I suffering losses and wish I hadn't produced so much? Okay, last question, be really quick here, from Erica. Would it be correct to say that in a barter society, a general glut is not possible because the price of each product is directly correlated to each other product? So having a glut of lime, salt, and tequila, there would be a particular exchange value between each of those goods so that no merchant is left with more supply than he wants to hold. When there is a poorly responsive money, then it may appear that there is a glut. Because money is also a commodity, as long as the relative price of money can fluctuate with lime, salt, and tequila, there would be no general glut. So, yes, Erica, I think everything you said there is true. Let me just paraphrase that to be a bit clearer for the other students. In a barter economy, there mathematically cannot be a general glut, right? So that's not a theory I'm offering from a free market perspective. That's just an accounting truism, all right? Because when you're in a barter economy, if you're selling your good, the price is quoted in terms of some other merchant's good, because every exchange has a real good on both sides of the transaction. So from one person's point of view, he's the seller and the other guy's the buyer, but you could just as easily flip it and say, no, the other guy's the seller and the other guy's the buyer. There's really no buyer and seller distinction in barter. There's just people trading. And so if the orange price of chickens is too high, well, then necessarily the chicken price of oranges is too low. So if there's a glut of chickens, there has to be a shortage of oranges. There can't be a glut of chickens and a glut of oranges and a glut of everything else. Okay. Now, what happens if we're in a monetary commodity or a monetary economy? Well, one of the goods is the money goods. Call it gold. Now, that mathematical truism doesn't give us what we want. It can be the case that all the merchants who are trying to sell their goods against gold can find that they have a surplus. They produce too much of their stuff. They can't sell all their inventory for gold. So in other words, the people who own gold are not willing to buy all the inventory that's for sale at all the different prices of those goods quoted in terms of gold. And the reason that happens is because the one good that is in shortage is gold, which is the money in our example. And so yes, if you treat the money good as just anything else, then you can say, well, it's barter, and so you don't have a general glut. But the point is, that's sort of cheating, because when people talk about a general glut, they mean everything except money. They don't mean that there's also too much money. That's their whole point. They're saying, no, there's not enough money. So you're not blowing up the people worrying about a general glut by saying, no, mathematically, there would always be a shortage of money. That's their whole point. They're going to say, exactly, there's a shortage of money, there's a general glut of everything else. So now what Erica pointed out, though, in the last piece there, is even that, though, can only persist if the prices, for some reason, are stuck. Okay, so mathematically, we're just showing, yes, it's conceivable that you could have a general glut in every good except the money good. But now, economically, that can only persist if for some reason all the prices are too high, quoted in money, and for some reason can't fall. Okay, so under barter, it's not even an issue of, it's not an economic argument. It's just it's a mathematical argument. I don't care what the prices are. If the price of one good is too high, then necessarily the price of another good is too low. So that's how it works there. Now with a money economy, I can't rely just on that mathematical truism, because it could be that the one good that's absorbing all of the necessity for there being a shortage is the money good, which is what the critics are complaining about. But now I can invoke an economic argument and say, well, wait a minute, why is it that the price of all these goods quoted in gold is above the market clearing price, so that there's a surplus in all these other goods? Why wouldn't merchants start lowering their price quoted in gold to move their inventory so that there wouldn't be a surplus anymore? So that's the issue. Okay, well, let me stop there, guys, now. And so by tomorrow, I will post the readings that you need to do for next week from the general theory. And also, if you're taking the class for credit, I'll send out an email to remind you of everything, but that quiz should open up by Friday. Okay, so thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.